At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Do you want to learn how to manage your own investments? Are you ready to stop paying investment management fees and start building wealth? The DIY Investing Podcast is dedicated to providing you with the knowledge, skills, and resources you need to be a better investor. Learn how to make investments through the use of fundamental analysis, mental models, and business management insights. Now, here's your host, value investing expert, Trey Henninger.
Hello and welcome to the DIY Investing Podcast. My name is Trey Henninger and I'm your host. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get more great investing content. If you're listening on YouTube, hit the like button on this video. And any other platform, your 5-star rating and review are a great way to support the show. But most importantly, subscribe. Thank you for your support. So today's topic is one that I find very interesting, and it may be an area in which I disagree with the broad consensus in the value investing sphere. So I want to make the argument today to not use enterprise value. And I'm going to provide you with my thought process so that you can think it through, you can understand my point of view, and if you disagree, fine. If you agree, fine. But the point of the podcast is to provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision in your investing process. My thesis today is that enterprise value is the wrong metric to use when valuing companies as a minority shareholder. This is very important. Enterprise value is a metric that was originated in use by companies, by people looking to acquire other companies. I had an interview with Tobias Carlyle, who has the book Acquires Multiple, and Acquires Multiple is, of course, enterprise value divided by free cash flow. That is the method commonly used by acquiring companies in order to determine how to value a new company. But it is my assertion that you should not be using that metric. So what is enterprise value? Maybe you've heard of this before, maybe you haven't, but the enterprise value definition is quite simple. You take the market cap and you either add net debt to equal enterprise value, or you subtract net cash to get enterprise value. So very simply, let's say you have a company whose equity value, so if you take all the shares of stock, so because market cap is all the shares that's outstanding times the share price. So let's say we have 100 million shares outstanding and the share price is $10 per share, then your market cap is $1 billion. Because 100 million times 10 is 1 billion. Now let's say also that the company has $500 million in debt. Then the enterprise value for the company is $1 billion market cap plus $500 million in net debt, which is equal to $1.5 billion. And that would be the enterprise value. But let's reverse it now. And let's say that instead of having $500 million in net debt, the company has $500 million in net cash. So in this case, the enterprise value would have you subtract the cash from the market cap. So you'd have a $1 billion market cap minus $500 million in cash is equal to a $500 million enterprise value. So the difference in these two enterprise values is significant. On the one hand, With $500 million in cash, you have an enterprise value of $500 million. But if you have that same amount of money in debt, now your enterprise value is $1.5 billion, or three times as expensive as the company with net cash. So therefore, it'd be quite easy to understand why corporate takeovers' enterprise value is useful. You see, in a corporate takeover, you can't simply buy out the shareholders of a company. You also have to assume the debt. So if you're going to make an offer to purchase a company from someone, you're going to have to make an offer to buy out the equity shareholders at some price. You know, in our example, we had a $10 per share price. Maybe you have to offer $13 per share or $15 per share in order to convince those shareholders to sell out to you. But not only do you have to pay that premium in order to buy out the shareholders, you're also going to have to pay off the debt holders. And you can do this in one of two ways. You either assume the debt or you negotiate to pay off the debt at the time of acquisition. Most commonly, you just simply assume the debt, and it takes into account that excess cost. So the cost of a corporate takeover is the enterprise value. Now, this makes sense when you have debt, but it also makes sense when the company has cash. Because if you were to buy a company with cash, let's say it's sitting in their bank account, when you buy the company and you own it now, you now own everything in their bank account. So it's the cash in the bank is like a discount on the purchase price. So enterprise value can be either a discount on the market cap or a premium to the market cap based upon how much cash or debt is available. Now, I've explained why you might use enterprise value if you're a corporate takeover or if you're purchasing an entire company. But most of you listening to my show are not actively buying entire companies. If you are, feel free to give me a call. I'd love to talk to you. It'd be great to interview for this show. But if you're not, and I'm certainly not, at least not at this time, it's a different situation. Now you're a minority shareholder. You don't have control of the company. You don't have control of the debt. And you don't have access to the bank account. So all that should matter to you is how much the equity is worth. Now, you should still care if the company has cash, and you should care if the company has debt. But those can get in the way of doing a proper valuation. If you try to value the company using enterprise value, it's going to lead you astray. I don't think you should use enterprise value because you're not an acquiring shareholder. You're a minority shareholder, and the differences are absolutely key. As a minority shareholder, you cannot make a decision to take cash and pay off debt. You cannot make the decision to take cash and pay out a dividend. You cannot make the decision to take cash and reinvest in the business, and you cannot make a decision to take cash and buy back your stock. Those capital allocation decisions are vitally important to the outcome of your investment, but you don't make any of them. Instead, as a minority shareholder, the only thing you can do is outsource those decisions to the board of directors, who then hires a CEO and CFO to make those decisions for you. So the selection of the board and the selection of the CFO and CEO are critical decisions that will affect the returns on your investment. But it also means that using enterprise value is going to lead you astray. And this is why. When you use enterprise value, there are two different situations we need to consider. The first situation is when debt is greater than cash. So when debt is greater than cash, you're going to have to use the enterprise value definition of market cap plus net debt. And when you do that, you're going to say that the company is a higher cost than it would be if you simply used market cap. So in this situation, I think it's reasonable to still use enterprise value because you are punishing the company's valuation due to the presence of debt, which I think is reasonable. In the past, I have not done so. In the past, I've only used market cap for companies that have debt, and I've talked about them in terms of either free cash flow or owner's earnings in relation to or in multiple to the market cap, ignoring the amount of debt on hand. This would be using something like a PE ratio instead of a ratio based upon EV to free cash flow or something along those lines. And this is critically important because the leverage inherent in the debt adds additional risk to a company. And I have found over time that the presence of debt or net debt on a balance sheet is higher risk than I would have expected. It results in more negative outcomes than I would have expected. So if I were going to value a company with net debt, I would still use enterprise value. But most importantly, I wouldn't buy the company at all. So even in this scenario where I think it would be reasonable to use enterprise value for the valuation, I don't think you should do so because I think the risk inherent in investing in companies with leverage and net debt is not worth it. There are other companies out there that have net cash and are safer while still offering similar upside returns. So I think you can do better than investing in companies with net debt. So let's talk about the other situation now, when cash is greater than debt. So when cash is greater than debt, the formula for enterprise value would encourage you to take the market cap and subtract the net cash. So in our example, we had $1 billion in market cap, and we subtracted $500 million in net cash to say the company is worth $500 million. Now, I think this is a mistake as well. When you have cash greater than debt, I would encourage you to still use market cap instead of enterprise value. Why would I do this? I would do this because it's going to be more conservative. And I think being conservative as a value investor is going to serve you a lot better than trying to be as accurate as possible. One of the number one rules that everyone likes to talk about with value investing or any investing is that the first rule is to not lose money. And I think this is critically important, but people always say, oh yeah, don't lose money, but then they don't talk about what that actually means. And one of the things that means to me is that you don't take risks that you don't need to. And you need to be critically focused on your margin of safety. And what margin of safety means in layman's terms is it's the potential error in your estimate of the company's performance that you aren't anticipating. What is protecting you if you are wrong? And the more things you can throw into margin of safety, the more qualitative and quantitative analysis that you can use to back up your margin of safety, the better you will be as an investor. Now, your actual performance in any one individual investment won't necessarily be impacted by that. You can make investments in companies without any margin of safety at all, and you can make a lot of money. And you can make investments in companies with a huge margin of safety, and you can still lose money. But margin of safety helps, and it's a good practice to stand by. And so here I think this is really important. Instead of using enterprise value, or an enterprise value to free cash flow multiple, otherwise known as the acquirer's multiple, to value a company with net cash, I think you should really consider using market cap. And I want to go through an example here to talk about this. This whole show originated with a conversation I was having with one of our listeners about valuing companies. And they were making the assertion that they wanted to buy high quality companies, and they thought a reasonable multiple was an EV to free cash flow multiple of 12 times. So I decided to give them two scenarios, and those are the scenarios I want to walk you through today. Both of these companies are going to have an EV to free cash flow ratio of 12 times, but there are some differences. So EV is, of course, enterprise value, and FCF is free cash flow. So in scenario one, the enterprise value is $1.2 billion, and the free cash flow is $100 million, which means your EV to free cash flow ratio is 12 times. But the net cash for the company is $2 billion. What does this mean? Well, the formula for enterprise value was market cap minus net cash, which means that if the market cap, or which means if we know the enterprise value is $1.2 billion, in order to calculate market cap, we have to add the net cash back to it. So enterprise value of $1.2 billion, net cash of $2 billion, means that the market cap is $3.2 billion. In scenario one, you have a company here that we're going to assume is growing at 2% per year. So let's talk about scenario two. In scenario two, your company is also growing at 2% per year. The company also has an enterprise value of $1.2 billion. And the company also has a free cash flow of $100 million. So the enterprise value to free cash flow valuation of 12 times is identical between the two scenarios. The difference is in the amount of net cash on the balance sheet. In scenario one, we had net cash of $2 billion. But in scenario two, we have net cash of $100 million. Which means that instead of a market cap of $3.2 billion, in scenario two, the market cap is $1.3 billion. Both companies have growth of 2% per year. So what is the key difference here? The companies have identical free cash flow. The companies have identical enterprise value. But they have different amounts of net cash. If you use a valuation method of EV to free cash flow of 12 times, this can cause you a problem because these two companies are not identical in the margin of safety available. On the one hand, you might say, well, scenario one has a high margin of safety because I have $2 billion in net cash. That's a lot of money. But you're paying for it with a higher multiple on the free cash flow. So if we say interchangeably here, like free cash flow is interchangeable with earnings, you're paying an earnings ratio of 32 times in scenario one, but only 13 times in scenario two. That's because less of the balance sheet is set aside for cash in scenario two, so it's a more efficient company. It's able to earn the same amount of free cash flow with less excess cash on the balance sheet. Now, there's many reasons for this. This could be the same company, just with two different management teams. One management team preferring to be very conservative and holding a lot of cash, and the other management team having decided to give the cash out to shareholders. So the question I have for you is, if you were looking at these two companies, do you think, and you had to hold these companies for 10 years, do you think your expected returns are equivalent? I think the answer is very clearly no. Because let's say you held the companies for 10 years. No dividends were distributed in that time frame. Now, after 10 years, in both scenarios, the enterprise value of the company are the same. They both increased by $1 billion because the free cash flow of the company was $1 billion over 10 years. I'm taking out the growth for a second to make the math easy, but it's basically an extra $1 billion in enterprise value for each company. The difference is that $1 billion in increased value for scenario one is only a 30% increase in market cap, which means the investor in scenario one would only experience 3% annualized returns over that time period. Meanwhile, the investor in scenario two would experience returns closer to 10% a year because the value of the company would grow on the range of like 80 to 90% over that time period, because it's going from $1.3 billion in market cap to $2.3 billion in market cap instead of $3.2 to $4.2. The difference there is huge. Now, obviously, these companies would still probably have some sort of dividend policy, but they might not. They might have some sort of buyback policy. They might not. But the key point here is that the amount of net cash you carry on your balance sheet matters. Capital allocation matters. And most importantly, by using EBITDA free cash flow, you're going to come into situations where two companies might be valued identically on an EBITDA free cash flow basis, but one may be much more expensive on a PE ratio basis or a market cap basis than the other. Now, you could say, okay, well, this isn't fair because there's obvious differences here, and you would notice those differences. Perhaps. But I see this all the time when I hear other investors' pitches. They will pitch companies on an EV to free cash flow basis that have this exact problem. Your EV to free cash flow is at an 8% yield in scenario one, but your market cap to free cash flow is at a 3% yield. And so what happened over a 10-year time period is you earned 3% annual returns instead of 8% annual returns. And that is a huge difference. It's often not thought about inverting the situation and understanding what really happens to an owner of this company if capital allocation doesn't change. What I have seen is that a lot of times, unless there's a change in management, management is not going to change their capital allocation policy. If they are conservative, they are going to stay conservative. If they're aggressive, they're going to stay aggressive. And if they're making capital allocation decisions you don't agree with, they will probably continue to make capital allocation decisions you don't agree with. Likewise, if you find someone that makes capital allocations you like, they're likely to continue. The inertia present in this type of investing is key. You cannot underestimate the power of inertia and the refusal to change from how people have made decisions in the past. This could be called inertia mental model. It could be status quo bias, any piece along those lines. But I would rather bet on things not changing than things changing. So let's go back to my argument here. The key thesis here is that instead of using enterprise value, I would rather use market capitalization and have excess cash be part of your margin of safety. That applies for when cash is greater than your debt, you should be using market cap. On the other hand, when debt is greater than cash, while enterprise value is the proper theoretical method of valuing the company, I would rather skip it and move on. This is what I call my net cash or skip investing approach. There are plenty of companies out there that have net cash and offer really good investment returns. There's no need to settle for companies that are leveraged in order to get sufficient investing returns. And the problem is, companies that are leveraged usually don't have the option of becoming more leveraged while you own them. They're much more likely to deleverage while you own them. And a company that is deleveraging is going to offer poor equity returns compared to a company that is able to leverage up. Versus the opposite, if you buy a company that is not leveraged and has excess cash on their balance sheet, there's a chance that they could make acquisitions or growth internal initiatives that cause them to lever up their balance sheet while you own them, and that can supercharge your investment returns. This increases your margin of safety, and it increases your potential upside by focusing solely on companies with net cash. So I'm an advocate, and I haven't always been, but going forward, I'm an advocate for being a net cash or skip investing approach. Even though enterprise value is the proper way to value a company with net debt, you have no need to value every company in the investing universe. Why not simply focus on the companies that are most advantaged and have the least risk? Skip leveraged companies and find non-leveraged companies that offer similar levels of return. They exist. You might have to go to smaller companies. You might have to go to microcap companies. You might have to go underfollowed companies. But those companies are out there and they exist. So there's a few other questions here that are related that I want to work through because I think they're important. And they're related to this concept of using enterprise value. How do you handle excess cash and that sort of thing? So one of the questions that came up was, should you calculate return on invested capital or ROIC with cash or without cash? Well, the obvious answer is you can do both. If you calculate return on invested capital without cash, you will have a better idea of the underlying business that currently exists at the company. And that business, that the ROIC calculation in that case will tell you what the business itself is producing in terms of returns without consideration for current management. But what I prefer to do is to calculate return on invested capital with excess cash calculated involved. What this does is it punishes the company's potential returns based upon the amount of excess cash that management considers necessary to protect the business from downside. This gives you the returns of the business exclusive to the current management team. And this is important because if you calculate ROIC without excess cash, you're likely to overestimate your potential returns. But if you calculate it with excess cash, you're likely to underestimate potential returns. I would much rather underestimate my returns than overestimate them. So it's a conservative approach. The next step, is excess cash bad? Does a company holding excess cash mean the company is a poor capital allocator? Now, I think in almost all cases, holding too much excess cash lowers the returns of a company. The immediate counter argument is going to be, well, what about Warren Buffett? He holds so much cash and look at his returns. I think Warren Buffett here is probably the exception that helps prove the rule. Warren Buffett is an exceptional capital allocator. The average CEO is not. If you're looking at a random company, the odds that the CEO of that company is as good of a capital allocator as Warren Buffett is extremely low. Which means if you give credit to them holding excess cash, like you give credit to Warren Buffett holding excess cash, you're likely to be making a mistake. So I would much rather assume that a company holding too much excess cash is a poor capital allocator and move on accordingly, or not give too much credit for that cash, than to give credit for cash that may never enter my pocket or never earn an adequate return. And even Warren Buffett is likely to admit that he's probably held too much cash over the course of the last decade, and that more of the cash should have been invested or returned to shareholders in the form of buybacks, instead of sitting on the balance sheet for so many years. Whether he'd admit that or not in public, I'm not sure. But the excess cash has certainly lowered the potential returns of Berkshire Hathaway. Now, I'm not opposed to holding cash as a cushion for downturns. I just think management needs to be clear about the level at which the cash is set aside for downturns and which the cash is set aside for other reasons or lack of an impulse to find a good investment opportunity. A management should be able to clearly articulate the amount of cash they need. Warren Buffett used to do this. He said, I need $20 billion to protect against insurance liabilities in a bad year. Well, great. Then don't count $20 billion as part of the excess cash. Say that's part of working capital. Calculate returns on investment accordingly. and say the rest of the cash is excess. That way, if the cash drops below $20 billion, we're not going to blame Warren Buffett for saying, I can't do anything with cash for a few months until it gets up to my $20 billion number. But if it means if it's sitting at $100 billion, you can reasonably estimate that $80 billion should be spent elsewhere. The same is true for every company. CEOs should be able to reasonably estimate the amount of cash they need as a cushion, and they should articulate that to their investors. And if they do not articulate the proper level, then you should assume either they're a bad capital allocator who can't indicate what the cash is for, or all that cash is necessary working capital, and you should punish the company accordingly. So one quick comment on weighted average cost of capital. A common issue when calculating intrinsic value with enterprise value is people like to use weighted average cost of capital, or WACC. I consider this complete BS. This is a common part of modern portfolio theory, the efficient market hypothesis, this idea that cost of equity and cost of debt have different amounts. And while the theory behind it sounds good, there's a lot of bunk here. The problem is that in order to calculate weighted average cost of capital, you have to make massive assumptions. You have to assume that interest rates stay the same. You have to assume that the debt to equity ratio of the company stays the same from year to year, all the way into the future for your calculations. You have to assume that you can predict the future of interest rates, predict the future of capital allocation, predict the future of shares outstanding changing, equity changes, debt changes. These predictions are impossible to make. So even though you can create a nice theory that sounds good and looks like it has good math, it's complete bunk. Anyone using weighted average cost of capital, this is your warning. You should probably learn a different method, because you need to readdress the assumptions that are underlying that theory. They're out there. They're explicit about them. And when you realize that the assumptions are crap, you can change that. And you should understand that if you have bad assumptions, you're going to get bad results. And the other piece is, why even bother valuing debt? Simply value the equity, use the cost of equity, which should be equal to your discount rate, which for me is 10%. And then you can add the face value of the debt back to the company to get enterprise value if you choose to do that. Again, I don't encourage it. I think it's going to lead you astray. I think you're going to end up buying riskier companies if you use enterprise value, but that's your warning. So I'm not opposed to excess cash as a cushion, but I don't think you should give too much credit for it. You know, the common saying is that a bird in hand is better than two in the bush. The cash in your pocket, the cash in your portfolio, should be worth more to you than the cash in a company's balance sheet. It would be an absolute mistake to value a dollar on the balance sheet of one of your companies as equivalent to a dollar of portfolio value for you. Now, you should want companies to turn every dollar they have invested into being worth more than a dollar, and that's absolutely great, but you should not assume so in your valuation. You should only buy companies that are doing that, but assuming so in your valuation lowers your margin of safety. So the key message here is very simple. Be conservative. Don't give managers credit where they don't deserve it. So I'm going to give you a few different statements here that I think are useful guidelines for how I'm thinking about investments. I want them to be easily quotable, one, so you can share them. It's always great if you can share the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, but you can share these phrases, and I think they're also more memorable when you think about them in this manner. So here we go a few. Buy companies with net cash, but value them as if they had none. Buy companies with growth, but value them as if they had none. Buy companies with high growth, but value them as if they only had low growth. Buy companies with good capital allocation, but value them as if they did not. And buy companies with good management, but assume management is only average, because someday they will be. In conclusion, the key thesis for this episode is that instead of using enterprise value, I would rather use market capitalization and have excess cash be part of my margin of safety. And if debt exceeds cash on the balance sheet, simply skip it. Net cash or skip is a reasonable investment approach to reduce your investing mistakes. Too often, I think investors are trying to improve their successes in a portfolio when they should spend more time removing mistakes. Thank you for listening to this podcast. The full show notes for this episode, including my outline for today's show, are available at diyinvesting.org/episode102. I've been thinking about it, and sometimes these links won't work immediately when they come out. So you can always get the show notes in your podcast player. They will show up there. But the link might not work until a few days or a week after the show is released. But those episode numbers are available for all episodes of the show. And so if you're looking for a specific episode from the past, you can always go to diyinvesting.org/episode and then insert the episode number. Please remember, this is a listener-supported podcast. If you gain value from today's content, please consider supporting the show financially as a patron. You can become a patron at diyinvesting.org/patron. Your financial support is what allows me to continue creating this free investing content. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stop paying fees, start building wealth.
Thank you for listening to the DIY Investing Podcast. Please visit our website and subscribe to our email list at diyinvesting.org for guides, videos, and resources to help make you a better investor.
The DIY Investing Podcast is presented for general informational and entertainment purposes only. I have not considered your specific situation or risk profile, and I have not provided investment advice. The information presented on the DIY Investing Podcast should not be construed as investment advice. The views and opinions expressed on the DIY Investing Podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's host or sponsors. DIY Investing, its producers, sponsors, and host, Trey Henniger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based upon information or viewpoints presented on the DIY Investing Podcast.